You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library for an evening with Marissa Silver and Megan O'Rourke. How do we flesh out history? How do we create a portal to enter the past? In her beautiful new novel, Mary Coyne, Marissa Silver has given us an intriguing answer to those questions. A real-life photo taken by Dorothea Lange in 1936 becomes a fictional photo linking three different characters whose lives span 90 years. It's a narrative of mid-century hope, loss, and disenchantment that is, as Publishers Weekly noted, both universal and deeply personal. Who is the woman behind Dorothea Lange's iconic photo, Migrant Mother, that weary young woman with her children who came to encapsulate the quiet desperation of the Depression era? Silver fills in the untold story of the woman who did not reveal her identity until the end of her life. And I don't know if some of you saw a beautiful essay that Marissa wrote that's in the New York Times today, which talks about her adopted state of California, and she writes, "The land out here is a series of characters to me, as mysterious and alluring as any people I might invent on the pages." So yes, place also figures very poignantly in this novel. Marissa Silver's book, Mary Coyne, is her fifth work of fiction. It's the culmination of a three-year process of research and artistic exploration. And as I said, she'll discuss the creation of this novel tonight with poet and memoirist Megan O'Rourke. Marissa began her career as a film director, directing her first film, Old Enough, while she studied at Harvard University. She made her fiction debut at The New Yorker, and someone who will be on the stage tonight was her editor, where she was featured in that magazine's first debut fiction issue. Her books include two collections of short stories, Babe in Paradise and Alone with You, and three novels, No Direction Home, The God of War, a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Fiction, and the just-published Mary Coyne. She's the winner of the O. Henry Prize. Her fiction has been included in the Best American Short Stories, as well as many other anthologies. And Megan O'Rourke is a cultural critic, former fiction editor at The New Yorker, and the author of the poetry collections Once and Half Life. She's the recipient of many awards, including the inaugural May Sarton Poetry Prize, a Lannan Literary Fellowship, two Pushcart Prizes, and a Front Page Award for her cultural criticism. Her much-lauded memoir, The Long Goodbye, a beautiful story of grief and mourning, was published in 2011. Please join me in welcoming Marissa Silver and later Megan O'Rourke. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Louise. That was so much information. I feel like I don't have to do anything now. I'm so happy to be here. I love this library. I love this series, and I'm really happy to be a part of it. I'm going to read you, start by reading you just a section from the beginning of the lives of each of the main characters. The first one will be Mary Coyne, who is the character, the fictional character in the photograph. Tahlequah, Oklahoma, 1920. Her mother told her that she looked at people too hard. "It's like you're a robber trying to break inside a person's skin," Doris said as she threw a ball of dough against the table and attacked it with her big hands and the strength of her broad shoulders. "It makes you strange." "I'm not strange," Mary said, although she liked the idea that she might come to possess Toby unawares simply by the power of her gaze. She watched him in the field next over, guiding the horse and plow through the rows, the dirt turning dark as he passed, as if he were pulling a blanket over the raw earth. She watched him hoist bales of hay, wondering how his rattlebone frame could counter the weight of the dried grasses. Toby Coyne, that sickly boy, as all the mothers referred to him for years, shaking their heads sadly as if already committing him to a collective memory. He'd managed to outwit all expectations just by staying alive, beating back whooping cough and measles and scarlet fever, so that he became a miracle boy as well. Mary saw how people looked at him in town, their eyes narrowing as if they didn't trust that he was quite human. His cheeks were sunken below their bones, and Mary sat in church and thought about tracing those sharp ridges with her finger and then her tongue. As the preacher exhorted the congregants sitting shoulder to shoulder on the hard wooden benches to believe against the odds of bad planting seasons and poorer harvests, telling them that they should feel special for having been chosen by God to withstand his insults, she felt something reach down to the deepest part of her, as if a hand were touching her there, the way she sometimes touched herself at night, holding her breath, careful not to wake Betsy and Louise, who lay next to her, or her brothers, who slept on the other side of the house's single room. All the land, acres of chocolate dirt and golden lashes of wheat, the blue Cookson hills tangled with trees and networks of undergrowth, and the distant Ozarks, which seemed to Mary a mountain range big enough to cover the world. Yet in their churches and houses, in their schools, and even in their beds, people were always huddled in a bunch as if they had to mass together against the threat of too much freedom. Doris gathered the flattened yellow disc into a ball and pounded it with the meat of her fists. "You do this 3 times," she said. "3, not 2. "Should I write that down?" Mary said. "Don't be smart." "That's not likely." Mary knew how to read and write, and Mrs. Pettit had told her she was the best at sums in the whole class. But when Mary turned 16, her mother pulled her out of school. As far as Doris was concerned, Mary knew nothing of any real use. "Someone will shoot you for looking at them that hard, or worse," Doris muttered. "What worse?" But Mary knew the answer. She could tell that her mother sensed something moist and wanting in Mary's parted lips. "You trying to catch flies?" she'd say when the two of them walked through town. Mary was narrow-hipped with barely a chest, but it was something else about her that caught men's attention. A sultry dragged her gait, as if she were waiting for someone to step into her path and make her change direction. Her mother was right. She looked hard at the men who walked into the last house, which sat on the edge of town, far enough from the stores and saloon, the hotel, and the 2 churches that it resembled a child excluded from a schoolyard game. Men entered through the doorway, their shoulders bent low as if they were expecting some unseen hand to yank them away from their sinful intentions. She watched those same men when they came out again, too, their mouths as soft as bruised pears, their awareness adjusting to their sudden exposure. She watched the boys she'd known at school, too. They were nearly men now, a state of almost, which made what they had been and what they were becoming tantalizingly present at the very same time. The being of a thing was most powerful when it was seconds from extinction. A flower about to drop from its stem, a shot rabbit twitching its last. She studied the way these boys walked down the street, their inward turning toes lending their movements the same lumbering intensity of a baby just learning to walk. But it was Toby Coyne who drew her eyes the most, as if he were one of those trick cartoons in the newspaper where a woman's hat was actually a bird, or where a white man had one Chinaman eye. The fact of Toby's survival in the face of lifelong weakness suggested a persistence she craved more than she desired the obvious strength of the other boys, who would start wrestling with one another at a moment's notice, as if they couldn't think what else to do with all that fire inside them. Toby was like a spindly tree that had miraculously outlasted a tornado, left stripped and bare of leaves, but still standing while houses and barns lay in ruin. So that's the beginning of the Mary portion. And now I'm just going to read you the beginning of the first Vera section, which takes place in San Francisco in 1920. Vera is the photographer. It was a costume party to celebrate, well, no one really knew what was being celebrated. The loose collection of artists and poets and self-styled arbiters of taste Vera had befriended since moving to the city often seemed to spend more time playing than working, the parties themselves being a form of tableau vivant. Vera was meant to wear something outrageous. She knew one man who was coming as an orangutan, pink buttocks and all. But what she decided at the last moment was that she would dress like the society women she had begun to photograph in her studio on Sutter Street. These ladies were much derided by Vera's crowd as boringly conventional and corrupted by wealth, but they were the lifeblood of her work, and she was frankly mesmerized by the ease with which they moved through their lives. There was always a chauffeur-driven car following slowly behind them as they shopped, in case they became too tired to walk. Tea in silver pots stood at the ready should they need refreshment. If it began to rain, an umbrella would suddenly appear, held aloft by a maid. Vera was devoted to these women because they paid for her photographic services and recommended her to their friends and provided her with a living enough to rent a studio and eat out at a cafe on Saturday nights if she stuck to home-cooked boiled onions and beef on weekdays. But there was something ineffable about them that captivated her beyond her economic pragmatism.
Even the ones who had long noses or large foreheads held themselves as though these were the very attributes that defined elegance. The women knew they were rare prizes, and Vera had created a career of sorts taking photographs to prove them right. It would be interesting to try on that entitlement, at least for an evening. Vera borrowed a dress from Mimi Vandermeer, the daughter of a railroad manufacturer. A young woman besotted with all things artistic, Mimi was delighted when her photographer came up with the marvelous idea of dressing like her. Her merriment, a sure signal that she knew Vera could never pull off such a transformation. My photographer. Vera's clients often use the possessive, my driver, my girl at Gump's, as if Vera were one of a retinue, and in fact, she supposed she was. She stood in front of the mirror in the attic room she rented on Gough Street. The black velvet dress fell into a dangerous V down her back. The material gathered in loose folds over her chest and then again at her hips, ending mid-calf. It was the fashion of the day that Vera generally avoided, not because she was prudish, but because she did not like to show her bum leg. But tonight, she would be brave. Her limp could enhance the costume. It would lend her the air of insouciance she admired in her coterie of friends who walked down the street as if they had just been pulled from bed. Mimi had also lent her a string of false pearls, which Vera arranged as a choker with the extra length dangling down her back. When she moved, the pearls tapped against her spine like a man's searching fingers, a sensation that kept her focused on her purpose. She wanted sex. She was 20 years old, new to San Francisco, and her inexperience made her feel alone among people for whom sex was casual currency. Her little skirmish in New York, Bremer fondling her while she painted photographs in his uptown studio, staining lips and bluing eyes, had been enough to convince her that her withered leg did not make her hideous to a man in need. But Bremer was old, his kisses dry and craven. Even if she had been willing, he hadn't had the courage to do more than reach underneath her blouse while she rubbed her hips against him. Their encounter ended abruptly, with him slinking back into the studio, his hands covering the stain on the front of his trousers. She reconsidered the party. It was foolish to think she could hide in an elegant outfit when her history was as plain as her plain face and was apparent to anyone the moment they saw her take a step. She could summon the exact details of her illness and its aftermath as if it had all just happened yesterday, and not 13 years before, when she was Vera Duer, a 7-year-old in Hoboken, New Jersey. She'd woken in the center of the night feeling like she was balanced perfectly between dreaming and wakefulness. Her brother Leon was asleep in the bed next to hers. She could hear his adenoidal breathing, the slurp and effort of it. There was another person in the room, too, a dark shape by the closet door. She was not frightened the way she was when she had nightmares about kidnappers, only curious that a stranger should be standing near her closet, as if he wanted something to wear. She had always known that there was a shadow world of ghosts and goblins and witches, known that life was made up of things you could see and things that you couldn't, like your thoughts or the wind. These ideas often absorbed her, and Miss Hilt had sent a note home saying that if Vera didn't learn to pay attention, she would have to repeat the second grade. Her mother had given her a stinging potch on the fanny and said dreams were for sleep, period. Das Ende der Geschichte, the end of the story. Shh, shh, her mother insisted, shaking Vera by the shoulders. She put her lips to Vera's forehead. She's burning up, she cried, and then she was screaming in German the way she did whenever she argued with Vera's father about why he was home so late or why he forgot to bring the fish she asked for, and then Leon woke up and started crying. Next, Vera was in her father's arms as he ran down the stairs of the apartment building. He wore only his nightshirt, even though it was winter, and she worried that maybe someone would see his thin, hairy legs and would laugh at him. Everything was odd and wrong and painful at the same time, to be awake at night when she had school the next day, to be visited by a ghost who wanted her dresses, to be sweating even though it was such a cold January that her mother had bought her a new pair of boots lined with lamb's wool, which cost too much, and her mother didn't want to hear about it if Vera's toes started to push against the front of the boots before the winter was out, because money did not grow on trees. And now her father was running down the street with her in his arms, wearing his white nightshirt, which had once risen up when he reached for something on a high kitchen shelf, and she had caught a glimpse of his pink, wormy thing. That seems like a good place to stop. Thank you.
That was a wonderful... Can you guys hear me? I'm on now. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
That was really wonderful. I loved hearing the beginnings of both of those stories, which set up so many of the concerns in the book. Marissa and I were just remembering before we came out on stage that we met now 13 years ago, which seems improbable.
Yes. Megan was my first editor at The New Yorker, which, given the way she looks, made her about 12 at the time.
I was remembering that I actually didn't want Marissa. Marissa called and said, I'm going to be there for the New Yorker Festival. Why don't we meet up? And I was like, well, okay.
I better go put on my grown-up clothes.
I was concerned she wouldn't think I was a serious editor. But I remember vividly getting her collection of stories, Babe in Paradise. We were putting together the debut fiction issue. I think it might have been the first debut fiction issue. And I had been reading and reading and reading, you know, people would say, this is the next writer, this is the next writer. And, you know, most of those people, alas, were not. But then this book arrived, and immediately I knew this was somebody that we were going to publish in that issue, because the stories just had such a singular clarity and a kind of clear-headedness about all of the characters, which was really remarkable. And I think that that's what Mary Coyne has, too.
Thank you.
So to dive in, you know, obviously the heart of this book is this iconic photograph that Dorothea Lange took, Migrant Mother. What drew you to that? When did you know that was going to be the subject of this book?
Well, I had seen this photograph, you know, a million times, as I'm sure so many of you have, because it's so ubiquitous. I mean, it is the iconic photograph of the Depression, and it's probably one of the most iconic photographs of the 20th century. So I'd seen it in history books, and I'd seen it, it's on a postage stamp. I mean, it's, you know, it was very, you know, it was everywhere. But about 4 years ago, I went to an exhibit of Western photography at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and the photograph was included in that exhibit. And once again, I was drawn to it because it's magnetic to me, at least, and obviously to many people. But what kind of captured my attention this time was not the photograph only, but the piece of information that was next to the photograph, the curatorial information, which said that the woman in the photograph had not revealed who she was until she was old and dying and needed money for her health care. And that fact struck me so powerfully because I thought, why? I mean, especially in this day and age where people are claiming celebrity for, you know, picking up a napkin at a, you know, restaurant. So, I mean, the disjunction was severe. But I also just thought, you know, what about that photograph made her not say, this is me, for all of her life? Was she ashamed? Was she disenfranchised? Was she embarrassed? Was she, you know, what? It was just a question that sort of begged an answer. And so I began to investigate, at first, you know, the lives of the two real women, and then moved into fiction.
And why fiction? I mean, obviously you were already a fiction writer, but one might imagine telling this story in nonfiction. It's a story you could tell, actually, in nonfiction.
Well, you know,
nonfiction.
Yeah, you could. I mean, you could
absolutely.
I mean, although, yes. I mean, first of all, I'm not a nonfiction writer, so it would never occur to me. I just wouldn't go there. I think the minute I hear a real fact, I immediately begin to elaborate and invent and make associations, and it instantaneously not nonfiction. You know, it was interesting. As I was writing the book in the very beginning, they were Dorothea Lange and Florence Owens Thompson, which is the real name of the woman, in my mind. I mean, I wasn't writing them as such, but as I was researching it, I was researching those two women's lives. But then at one point, they became characters to me, and I guess it was when I began to invest them with interior lives, because although I used many of the facts, especially from Dorothea Lange's life, not that much is known about Florence Thompson without becoming a nonfiction writer and spending years digging through information. You know, I can't presuppose what they thought or felt at any given time. And so the minute I began to invest these people with feelings, with thoughts, with motivations, with, you know, situations in their lives that would bring out certain personality, certain aspects of their personality, they became fictional characters to me. And the other thing is, when I was writing the book, sort of the main sort of thematic thrust for me as a writer, maybe not for a reader, but was this sort of thinking a lot about what history is. And what happens to history once it happens? It becomes interpreted. It becomes recontextualized over time. You know, when somebody from a century later looks back at history, they're looking back at that history with a whole set of assumptions and you know, values that may not have existed at that time. So they're repurposing history, and we repurpose it for our own uses also. So I understood that something that real that happened became, to some degree, fictionalized over time. And in the same way, I understood that my characters, although they were rooted in these real people, were going to be transmuted, or, you know, they were going to morph through my reinterpretation. So that was also part of what I began to understand as I wrote the book.
I think that piece about history feels very apparent to the reader. There's an early moment. It's one of the wonderful things about the book. There's an early moment when Walker, who's the third character, who we'll talk about a little bit later, he's a teacher of cultural history, a professor of cultural history, and he is thinking about what happens to his work. And there's a sort of, it seemed in that moment almost like you were creating an analogy to what the novelist does, that, you know, one tells a story and it goes out there and then where does it go and what does it mean?
Yeah. That Walker, although he is not a stand-in character for me in any way, he's a cultural historian, which means that he's someone who spends his time sort of sifting through the artifacts of history rather than the facts of history. He's not so much interested in the treaties and the laws as he is in the ephemera that he finds in newspaper morgues and, you know, boxes of photographs, and trying to recreate what lived life was like at a certain time. And, you know, his understanding of how we reinvent the past with these artifacts is obviously very much what a novelist does. And, you know, that gave me a way into thinking about his journey.
And something you kind of hint at in the book, but is present too for me in the reading of it, is, of course, history is the story we tell ourselves after the fact, but when Dorothea Lange was taking that photograph, I believe to some degree she staged and shaped that photograph, mm-hmm. right, which became this iconic image of the suffering of the Great Depression. And I don't know if you remember, but the migrant mother is looking off to the side, I think she's looking off to the side, and then two of her children are behind her with their faces away from the right. camera, right, and then one is...
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, that was such an interesting thing, because she's a, you know, a documentary photographer. The whole question of photography and its relationship to truth is a big part of this book. And she did ask those children to turn around, and a lot of people think that that's sort of verboten. You know, if you're going to be taking, you know, the pictures of life as is, you should take the pictures of life as is. I'm not sure that the minute, I mean, my opinion is that the minute you lift a camera, you're changing the life. You're inserting something into a moment that didn't exist before. People are being seen in a way that they didn't before. So I think the fact of a camera already moves something from being real to something else. I'm not sure what that something else is labeled. But she did turn the children around. And you know, she only took, I think, 6 photographs that day when she came upon Florence Thompson and her children. And so it was quick. I mean, it probably took her 10, 15 minutes to do the whole thing. They barely had a conversation. She didn't get the woman's name because part of the, she was working for the WPA. That's when all those photographs were taken. And part of the rules of that was that they didn't take the names of the people they photographed because they didn't want to put those people in any kind of danger. They didn't want those people to be fired from jobs by, you know, because they didn't, people, farmers were worried about strikers and, you know, all sorts of rabble-rousers. So they were trying to protect the, which is interesting because then she was protected, but also she became anonymous, which is not so protective. But she told those kids to turn around. She must have just, it's that artistic impulse. She had a sense. I invested that moment with emotion based on the characters that I created. I don't know what her impulse came from to turn those children around, but you sort of think, what would the photograph have looked like if those children were looking out of the camera? And I think it would have a different kind of value, and it probably wouldn't have been as strong. There's something very poignant about their necks, this little smudges of dirt that you see on them. The fact that they're turned away is almost, you know, that they're hiding in her, that she's protecting them. It's a very maternal image. The image sort of evokes, and she's holding a baby, so the image really evokes almost like a Mary and baby Jesus formulation, which I think is one of the reasons why it captures, you know, has sort of stuck with people. It sort of reaches back to some iconography that we're used to, you know, almost like a Jungian kind of symbol. That's an interesting thing that she posed it. But, you know, to me, it's you know, it's an artificial thing to be photographed to begin with. So I don't have such a judgment about it.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, in a way, your relationship to them, to the characters you've created, is a little bit parallel to Dorothea Lange's relationship to that kind
yes,
of
I manipulated
tableau.
Them and turned
right.
them around.
Successfully. But, you know, of course, that's one of the things one thinks about reading this book is, for the reader, even though the names are changed, one is always aware of that kind of shadow of reality right. behind it, which is one of the things I love about the book. It kind of makes you think about what we think of as reality, the fact that we're always telling ourselves stories in order to arrive at what we think of as truth. What were some of the specific in your other books, I think you haven't worked from a real story.
Right.
What are the problems of reality for a fiction writer? Were there
problems?
Well,
for me, I can only speak for me. I mean, people do it so differently. You know, I mean, Don DeLillo writes, you know, Libra and uses the names of all the people and yeah. then massively invents. So for me, the issue was an issue of feeling like, you know, that I wanted to be respectful to the real people who existed, and yet I wanted to fictionalize, and I wanted to move into an imaginative space. So it was really, the problem for me was allowing myself to do that. I guess my first job in life was making a documentary film, which actually has a lot to do with what drew me into this. I was a young filmmaker, and I was hired to co-direct a film with another filmmaker about fundamental Christians living in Indiana. And we went out to Muncie, Indiana, and we lived with this family of charismatic Christians, which is like a tongue-speaking, you know, very extreme fundamental sect. And, you know, we lived with them when we filmed them. And when I was very young, I was 20, but I really understood it when we were doing that, the strange bargain that was struck between we, the filmmakers, and they, the subjects, and that it was, everyone was getting something out of it. I mean, there was some reason why they wanted to have this film. We were almost like therapy for them, and we were, but at the same time, I knew that they did not understand the level of exposure that was going on. I mean, no one can. No one can really understand what it means to be on television, to have your, you know, to have a photograph reproduced a million times. No one can understand. Even if you said to someone, this is what's going to happen, no one would understand what it would feel like to have that kind of exposure. So, So I think because my early career had a lot to do with issues of realism. Yeah. And documenting reality and what are the, so I think it was the same qualms and the same issues about what, you know, am I documenting reality? Am I changing reality? How much am I allowed to diverge from what happened? And so those were the issues that for me were very, because I, you know, another person writing that book may not have had any issues with that. Right. But for me, it took about a year for me to feel comfortable saying, okay, this is invention. Yeah. And I can use this material that exists, you know, certain aspects of, you know, Dorothea Lange had childhood polio and she walked with a limp, and the character in my book does as well. But I can use that and then almost like invent on top of it. Or I sometimes thought about it like that I was sampling a piece of music, you know, that I was using bits and pieces but creating my own music from it.
It does feel that way, especially I think taking other names gives you a particular license.
Yeah, the minute I got the names, then I was like free to fly.
And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about was the question of whether, and we've talked about this before, whether one would call this a historical novel, right? I remember interviewing E.L. Doctorow once, and I said something about the historical novel, and he said, what are you talking about? And I thought, I better back up. So,
whoops.
You know, and actually, I think I understand his point in the same way I understand maybe you're not thinking of this book as a historical novel, in that when I think of the historical novel as a genre, I think of books where the research is so crammed in and every character is not just reading a book, they're reading a pigskin book, right? You know, that you can see the sweat of the labor. And one of the things I loved about this book was that it is a novel of history. I really felt at the end I understood the Great Depression in a visceral way that I never had before. But I wonder how you think of it. Do you think of this question, historical novel, novel of history? Because
I don't think it's a historical novel. I mean, I'm not actually a big reader of historical novels, and oftentimes when I read historical novels, I spend the whole time going, yeah, but how do you know that's what they thought? I mean, so I have a very hard time making that leap to sort of, you know, that kind of combination of the real and the imagined for me as a reader is sometimes difficult. I don't think of it as in that genre. I think of it as a literary novel, you know, set in a time and a place. And in terms of the research aspect is, you know, and you're right, there are these books that are sort of drenched in research to the point sometimes where you feel like you're reading a writer's research and maybe sometimes even it's burying the book, that the book doesn't take sort of imaginative flight because the research, you sort of go, yeah, look, they must have figured out how the pigskin was made. And, you know, and what I found researching was that, I mean, I did an enormous amount of research that isn't on the page, but what I felt like needed to be on the page was information that would elucidate character. So that if it didn't matter to Mary whether or not she was reading a pigskin, you know, then if it said nothing about her, if it didn't let the reader know any more about her than if she had been reading, you know, a plastic page, then it wasn't a piece of information that was meaningful to me, because I always approach all my work, no matter when it's set, from character first. And so what I found researching was the things that popped out at me were the things where I thought the relationship between a character and that piece of information is going to be resonant and is going to let the reader know more, know that character more, not just simply know the time and say, oh, this really happened in 1932 or whatever, but know the character more. So I actually stripped away a lot of the research because it just felt like, you know, I don't need to prove that I, you know, read about how, you know, the wheel wells of the Hudson in 1930 looked. I mean, it doesn't matter if the character didn't care. But if the character had cared, or if that had been something that would have told me more about her, then it would have been included.
Well, I want to go back to character. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about when you talked about, there was a moment when you knew Mary and you knew Vera. And I do think of character as being the core of your work, these incredibly crystalline people that seem just utterly real. How do you come to know character? Is it through this process of reading and finding moments that resonate? Is it through a kind of piece of language? Do you hear something that they might say and then that establishes them for you? What is that process like?
I wish it were obvious, because then I would be able to do it all the time and I wouldn't struggle. it's this really inchoate process for me. I mean, I start out with characters with very scant information about them. Maybe I have a sense of their hair color, or that they have a gravelly voice, or, you know, something very superficial. And then I begin to, I create scenes in which the character has to behave. So they have to act in a certain way. And then when I decide how they behave in that scene, then I look at that and I say, well, who is that person that behaved that way? And I begin to build it bit by bit by bit by bit by throwing sort of action in their way. And then having them behave. I'm making them do this stuff. It's not like some, you know, magical thing that they are behaving. But and then I begin to, so I guess it's through action that the characters reveal themselves to me. It's not so much through interior thoughts. Mm-hmm. That comes a little bit later for me. Like, I get the interior, there's the sense of their interiority later, after I get the sense of how they behave, how they, you know, how does that mother in the first scene I read, she throws down the dough on the table. That's a very, in my mind, when I had her, instead of placing the dough down, she smacks it down and she hits it with the fist of her hand. That tells me a lot about who that mother is and what her attitude is towards her life. And then I can begin to build from there. So it's this kind of very herky-jerky building of bits and pieces. And then at some point, I feel like I know who they are and I could basically put them anywhere and they would behave in a way that was either consistent or inconsistent the way a character would be inconsistent. I don't know when that moment happens. It's, you know, who knows where, but once that happens, I can sort of, you know, I can go. But there's a lot of, you know, going back and saying, okay, well, you know, if she did this and I like that, then I have to go back and how did she behave then? And so it's kind of like getting to know a human. I mean, a person. Yeah. It's like you meet a person at a party and you see something superficial about them. You say, you know, she has this kind of hair, or she, or he, you know, dresses, he pressed his jeans or something. So you then suddenly make all these associations with pressed jeans. But then you hear them talk and you say, oh, well, my initial idea of them is maybe different because they just said this, or they just did this, or look at the way they're holding it. And so you begin little by little to sculpt your understanding of that person. And that's a lot of the way that I deal with characters.
So is that a lot of the revision you do, would you say? Is that kind of early on? Is that the bulk of the writing?
I think that's the early on stuff. The revision stuff is much more having to do with moving a story forward and making a character go through an arc that feels satisfying for a reader and that tells the story that I want to tell. So I think getting the character is sort of the first thing, and then it's about, I mean, plot is not my strongest point. Mm-hmm. So then it's about how do I move it forward? And I'm always thinking, what is going to make a reader turn the page? What is going to make them want to know the next thing and the next thing? Especially, this is a book that has three different characters and the narrative alternates. And so I had to always make sure that when I dropped off one character, I left with a question or some compelling need to pick up with that character another time. So, and then it's just a lot of problem solving. It's like, you know, somebody asked me, do I get moved by my books, you know, emotionally? And I feel bad that I don't, but, you know, because for me, I mean, I don't have the, unfortunately, and I probably this is true of every writer, you don't ever get to have the feeling of a reader reading your book for the first time, which is a shame, but it's really more like solving a math problem, you know, with a set of problems that you have to fit together, and, you know, so that's what it's like
for me. Especially in this book, because as you say, there's this profound formal structure of the three characters.
Right.
So Mary Coyne, Vera, and then Walker Dodge. And I don't want to give too much away about the plot.
Don't.
I'm not going to. Don't worry. But these stories come together in various ways. And this actually strikes me, I was thinking that this strikes me as a very contemporary form, that this is a form we see a lot today. And then I was thinking, actually, it's a form that Bleak House uses.
Yeah.
You know, so it is actually a wonderful form for driving the story forward. But talk, how did you come to that form? And
well, I knew that there were always going to be these three characters. I mean, I knew that it was the photographer and the subject. And then I really felt strongly that I wanted there to be a contemporary character because I needed someone to be looking backwards. I needed a historian. I needed someone to be doing the thinking that I was doing as a writer. And I played with a lot. I mean, there was, you know, I had these different chapters of each character, and I mixed and matched them in all sorts of ways. I mean, there were times when the book was short chapters, alternating characters, you know, over, you know, many, many times. And there were times when, you know, different sections went before other sections. So it was really kind of this very intuitive sense of how does the story unfold? I mean, part of writing is how do you as a writer deliver information to your reader in a way that creates a sense of mystery and unfolding? And so for me, it was looking at this information I had and how could I combine these stories in a way where they spoke to one another and created that mystery for the reader so that there was a sense of growing understanding of how these three stories knit together and a growing understanding of the themes that knitting reveal. So it was, you know, there was a lot of spreading out the papers on my floor and joining them together in different ways. But ultimately, I came to this. It's three stories that you return to three times, but in very unequal amounts. And at first I thought, oh no, that doesn't, you know, that's not pretty. And it doesn't feel like you should spend, you know, 30 pages with this one and 30 pages. Then I thought, you know, stories have, no matter how long or short they are, they have different weight. And something that's 2 pages can be as weighty as something that's 30 pages in a reader's mind. So it was trying to understand, you know, what the relative weights of these stories are and where they needed to land.
I didn't actually notice that till I was rereading the book for tonight, how different those pages were. So Walker also, so he functioned as a character looking back. I want to read a line from the book. He's thinking early on about this class he's teaching in cultural history where he's having the students, college students, mm-hmm. look at photographs. And he thinks, or he says, this is not a class about looking. This is a class about seeing past predetermined historic and aesthetic values. And a lot of that early section is about pulling out the difference between looking and seeing. And it strikes me that he's a crucial part of the book, too, because he's our very contemporary entrance into thinking about, it seems to me one of the things this book does, even though it's set so much in the past, is think about a culture in which we're constantly seeing but maybe not looking. Or looking, but maybe not seeing. And so I thought maybe you could talk a bit about
that. Well, I think, we're assaulted by images constantly, and they just go by us, you know, on the internet or whatever, and we hardly, you know, penetrate them. We live in this very surfacey kind of world. And his ambition is to look around the margins of an image and to say, well, here's this picture of a kid licking a lollipop, but what was happening on the margins? What was happening off frame? You know, widen out your ability to think about something as this. Think about it in a larger way. And I guess, you know, that's very much my journey as a writer, too, is what's around the corner of the action. Sometimes what's around the corner of the action is more interesting than the action, which is something I learned from that first filmmaking experience with the filmmaker I was working with, who was a very famous documentarian named Richard Leacock. I don't know, some of you may know his work. And he had created this cinema verite style of filmmaking, which was very much sort of, you know, on the fly capturing quote-unquote reality instead of, you know, formal posing of reality. But sometimes I would watch him, and he was the cameraman, and I was taking the sound, and sometimes I was, you know, we'd be listening to two people talking, and then suddenly he would just be wandering off, and he would focus his camera on, you know, something really obscure. I mean, some of his most famous images in the history of his filmmaking life have to do with that. But, you know, because something, it's like pulling out that resonant detail, and he would find the resonant detail way off the frame. So I guess what I'm interested in looking is what do you see beyond the surface? How can you look into and around something obvious and understand how it what the full story that an image tells is?
Yeah. I think that's, again, one of the things this book, for me, does so well is, if you haven't read it, you have to read it. It's really wonderful. And it really, I have such vivid memories of seeing photographs of the Great Depression. I think this is an era that, you know, it haunts our history. It seems kind of unthinkable in certain ways, even though we're here in a recession. And I have those vivid memories of seeing the tents, you know. Mm-hmm. But this was the first time I felt I could experience it as kind of life, rather than history.
Right. Well, that was very much my hope in writing the book, was to sort of infuse it with life and, you know, real lived life. You know, people who fall in love and have families and, you know, it's not, I didn't want to sort of, sometimes we treat history as this very precious thing that we're not allowed to really investigate, that we're not allowed to understand the kind of rough edges of and the dirty parts of and the messy parts of, that it's almost like a museum thing. And I'm not, I mean, in the same way that I wasn't interested in treating the photograph as this precious object, I was interested in treating it as something, you know, real, lived, felt, touched, palpable. You know, it's not a precious, I didn't want to be precious about it.
Oh. This is a totally different question, but one of the things the book does really well is kind of inhabit the lives of women. And I know actually you write a lot about men. Is it different to write about men? Do you?
I don't think so. Yeah. For me, I mean, I think that it's just about inhabiting a life.
Yeah.
And I do write a lot. I mean, my last novel was about boys and men. And no, I don't feel that it's different. I never have that feeling of like, oh my, you know, I just think it's once I inhabit a life, I'm there with it. And I don't feel sort of, because I'm not a man, I can't write. I don't feel that.
Yeah. No. Yeah. No, it doesn't feel that way at all. And in fact, some of the scenes of Walker being a parent, he's also a parent in the book, are some of the most vivid, I think, for me. Changing tacks, so you came to writing from a career in filmmaking, as you've said. What was it like to make that switch? Was it difficult? Was it natural?
Well, for me, I had sort of come to the conclusion that although I was, you know, making films and to some degree, you know, having some success in making movies, I really felt like the stories that I was telling in film, by and large, were not stories that were not the stories that I really wanted to tell. And I wanted to tell stories that were maybe kind of smaller and more intimate than what most movies, especially these days, are about. And so I was, it was not, I came to that moment, it was a very clear moment for me. It wasn't hard to, I also had the incredible support of my wonderful husband, who, you know, was all for putting aside a fairly lucrative career and taking up a fairly unlucrative career. So, so, you know, I was lucky in that way. But it was just really the sense of that I knew I wanted to tell stories, but I wasn't telling stories in a way that I felt that I was talking about the things about living and about life that moved me as much as I wanted to. And so it was really a wonderful liberation in a certain way. I mean, I had to learn how to write. It wasn't something I had done much of. And but it was, I also realized that, you know, I actually am much more of a lone ranger than a collaborator. And you know, when people get up on the award shows and they talk about how, you know, how collaboration is so wonderful, and I'm like, no. I really like to be alone. I like to be in command of my whole little imaginative world. I don't want somebody to come and tell me, you know, what color the dress should be, or, you know. So in that sense, it really fit me as a person much better. But no, it was very liberating, and I was very, you know, once I sort of entered the world of writing, I felt like, I can tell the tiniest little story. Mm-hmm. No one's going to say, we're not going to finance that, you know.
It's true that there's not really an equivalent to the short story in film, right?
Right. I mean, there are short films, but there's no way you can make money doing that.
Well, short stories probably also difficult. Moving on from that topic, Louise mentioned in her introduction a piece you wrote that was in the Times today that I read about being a Californian writer and the struggle with place as a signifier. Mm-hmm. And I just thought maybe you could talk a little bit about
Well, you know, people have often, they often call me and many writers who live in California, California writers. And I think a lot of us sort of rankle at that because what's different between a California writer and a person who lives in New York or a person who lives in Texas or a person, you know, what, I mean, yes, there are regional, you know, regional literatures that we all think of. We think of Southern literature and we think of Flannery O'Connor and William Faulkner and we, you know, and there's Western literature, but there, but, you know, somehow the idea of being a California writer, I think, rankles a lot of people because it also feels like it's part and parcel of this sort of dismissal of the whole California thing by the rest of the world, that you know, there's a certain stereotyping that goes on, and these old tropes of, like, bubble-headedness and sun-drenched and, you know, it never stops. And so I was asked to write about that, but as I wrote the piece, I realized what it means to me to be a California writer, because instead of sort of having a lot of sour grapes about it and saying, you know, I don't want to be, I sort of thought, well, wait a minute. Let me look at this and say, well, what does it mean to me? And what I realized in the piece, you know, if you haven't read it, is I was a filmmaker in New York, and New York is where I grew up, and I always, you know, I'm a New Yorker from birth, but when I became a writer, I was a Californian. I discovered myself as a writer here in California. And when I started writing stories set in California and the landscape and the people and the land and what was going on culturally and the weird ironies of life here were incredible fodder for me, maybe because I was seeing it from the outside, maybe because it wasn't something I'd grown up with and taken for granted, but it was something I was seeing as an adult, and I had a kind of an adult's understanding of it. And so I sort of understood for myself what being a California writer is, and, you know, I sort of feel like, great, it's a great state, and it's a great place to write about, and I'm sure that I will write stories, and I know I will write, you know, novels and stories that take place other places, but this is the place and the landscape and the cultural kind of geography that formed me as a writer.
It always seems funny too that it should be in any way dismissive, because of course California is kind of the end of the American story, right? It's occupies such a huge place in the American story.
Well, there's a lot that could be said, and it would take hours to talk about it, about what is the strange unwillingness to accept California as a fully formed place, you know, and why are these stereotypes endlessly regurgitated? I mean, to some extent, you know, California serves it up on a platter, you know, some of the tabloid stuff, and, you know, but there, you know, as we all know living here, the richness of this state is so varied, and, you know, there are rainforests here, and there are Indian tribes, and there, I mean, it's so culturally rich, and maybe the Britney Spears of it is the tiniest part, but that's the part that gets in People magazine. So, you know, I think that the rest of the country has served up a very narrow view, and therefore these stereotypes get perpetuated, but in fact we all know that it's a very complex and rich place that has as much to do with America as any place in this country. So, you know, I don't know that it's ever going to end, you know? It's like New Jersey's never going to get over being New Jersey, and we're never going to get over being California.
But New Jersey also is the site of many great novels.
Yes,
and
Philip Roth, that's what
shows.
I always
right.
say.
Philip Roth,
many. So nobody calls Philip Roth a New Jersey writer, right. strangely. But California still is a label that is irresistible to people.
Right, it's
so
true.
I say, you know what? Embrace it. Don't fight it.
So I'm going to ask you a question people always ask me, and I never quite know how to answer. But especially because you become so involved with your characters, is it difficult to end the books? And how do you know when you're going to end them? I mean, at what point do you say I guess there's two issues. One is the issue of research in a book like this. Mm-hmm. When do you know you've done enough? And the other is, have you told the story you want to tell? And
I always sort of know when I've told the story. You get this feeling like at the end of a symphony or at the end of a piece of music that it's sort of resolved, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's resolved in a way where the questions are not all answered. I mean, to me, the perfect ending of a novel, for me, is one where you both feel satisfied and you feel filled with a sense of searching and a sense of opening up. You know, when you have that ah feeling when you finish a great book that you love, it's not because the story's over, spick, span, you know, it's done, finished. It's because you're suddenly thinking about life in a new way, and you're suddenly some lines of inquiry have been opened up to you by the book. So for me, when I get to that point where I feel like, okay, certain stories are over and yet certain questions are suddenly asked, then I feel like the book is over. And no, I have never have a problem saying goodbye to characters. I feel like you live with them for 3 years, they're like, you know.
You're like house guests that overstayed their welcome.
But also characters for me, they live in the book. They don't live outside the book. You know, I know a lot of writers talk about, you know, their characters as being almost like people in their lives, but I don't feel that way. I'm kind of more cut and dried about the whole thing. It's like, I know what my real life is, and I know what my makeup life is. And so, and also it's such a struggle to make something work that when you feel like you got it, it's like, I am very happy to have it be done.
Yeah.
And very, you know.
Did you feel that you came to know more about that period in American history, about Dorothea Lange? Do you feel that the book translated into a sense beyond its scope? Or for you was really about developing the situations and the lives of those particular characters in the context, the fictional context you created?
I certainly know more facts, you know? I mean, I think I was so narrowly focused on these people in their environment that I'm not sure that I could honestly say that I, you know, somehow have this, you know, greater, bigger, I could give lectures on, you know, understanding of the time. But, you know, I certainly know more than I ever knew about. But, you know, for instance, I don't understand much more about the economics of the Depression. I didn't need to know that. That wasn't something my characters needed to know. So I probably know more about, you know, how you pick cotton and how you fell trees in Northern California and how the Indians came on the Trail of Tears to Eastern Oklahoma. But I'm not sure that I have a kind of, you know, I wouldn't, you know, claim that.
Well, one part of the novel in the novel, and I don't know if this is true of Florence, but she's part Cherokee, mm-hmm. right? And was that true of Florence also?
Yeah. Florence Thompson, the woman in the real photograph, was born in Eastern Oklahoma, like my character Mary Coyne, and she is either part or full Cherokee. It's not quite clear. There's a lot of contradictory information about her in the information that I found. But she, you know, definitely her forebears had come across from the east on the famous Trail of Tears, where a lot of Cherokee Indians were, you know, kicked out of their homelands on the East Coast and ended up in places like Oklahoma. And she grew up in a sod house and on a subsistence farm. And she married this guy, and they moved to California. And so a lot of the framework of Mary Coyne's life is very much the framework of the real life.
Well, I think it's time to take some questions from the audience. I think there's going to be microphones. I see them in the back, and they're going to come around. And then,
wondering about the woman in the picture. By coming, you were talking about celebrity, and this is more about real life than your book, but by coming out publicly, was she able to raise the funds? How did she monetize that so that she could get her health care? How did that all turn out in real life?
Yeah, she raised about, about $30,000. People were sending in $5, $1. You know, I think people were very moved by it. In fact, the truth was, it wasn't the, she had written this letter to a magazine to try to, like a cease and desist letter much earlier, like decades earlier, to say, you know, stop printing this photograph. I'm not getting any money for it, but nothing came of that. And she did raise some money. I mean, she passed away soon thereafter, but they did raise some money. People were very moved by it. I mean, I think people were also moved by the fact that she was anonymous and that she wasn't given her due in any way. I mean, she didn't claim it, but she also wasn't given it, you know, and that's a question also that the book brings up. It's like, you know, when somebody becomes famous in a news photograph and they, you know, they're used for all sorts of other reasons, is that person owed something, or are they just a fact of life that somebody caught on a camera and then their tough luck, they happen to be there doing that interesting thing, you know? So that's I think something that's one of the questions in the book for sure.
Did Dorothea Lange make much money from it, or was it owned by the WPA?
She didn't make specifically money from that photograph, but obviously her career took off. Right, so you could say that she benefited hugely from that photograph. But she never tried to find the woman or, you know,
or other questions? Yeah.
I was curious about the name Mary Coyne, how you came upon that and when in the process, and if you felt like you'd hit gold when you got it and when you knew it was going to be the title?
This is embarrassing, but I think that a friend of mine, and when I were talking, she's a writer, Rachel Kushner was talking, I don't know if he's here tonight, but she had talked about a character, and I think that character's name had a coin in it, I can't remember what it was. And then months later I said, I thought of the most wonderful name for my character, Mary Coyne, and she looked at me like, well, yeah, we were talking about that. But I think it came, I think subconsciously it's brewed with me. First of all, I mean, Mary, even though I wasn't thinking this at the time, I think the fact of the photograph being this kind of pietà, suggestive of the pietà, must have been in my subconscious. And also, you know, she became currency. And she became something that was bought and sold and traded. She became this stamp that had value. So I think that although it wasn't something I sat there and thinking, what could be a currency, when the name came to me or Rachel suggested that name, obviously my subconscious kind of put it together with themes that I was thinking about. So yeah, but it did feel like, you know, names are funny because oftentimes I'll have a name and I can't keep writing because it's not the right name. Mm. And it's just this weird thing. And it can be something really stupid. I mean, the name can be Sally and I think it should be, you know, June. And once it's June, I can write it. It's not meaningful. But certain, you know, it's like anything. Certain names have connotations or senses or on the mouth or in the, you know, that. So it's once I hit a name. And Vera Dare was the same thing. I mean, her, it just felt like a name that somehow evoked her character to me, not in a Dickensian way. It's not like the names sort of are like, you know, Mr. Bumble. But, you know, for me, it felt like that's the name of this person.
My question is also about the name choice. I find it ironic that Florence did not gain anything monetarily, and the name of your character's last name is Coyne. Also, at the end of her life, she was found by the reporter from the Sacramento Bee, and that's how she became to be known. She spent 42 years hiding from this identity because of some deep shame she felt about that photograph. So I was wondering if you knew about that and how you – did you struggle with her personally not wanting to be attached to the photo and then writing this book?
I did know all that information. I didn't struggle with it because, she did reveal who she was, and so – she made that choice. And she had actually also been on the Today Show earlier. That piece of information in the museum actually wasn't entirely correct. So she wasn't, and no, because I was in the fictional world at that point. I did not feel, you know, had I been writing a nonfiction book, I think it would have been a whole different thing. And I would have spent time tracking down her grandchildren and her, you know, really, but because it was a fiction and I felt very comfortable saying, you know, I'm writing about Mary Coyne. And it, as Megan so beautifully said, it has this shadow of reality behind it, but it's not. So no, but yes, all that information about, you know, I knew that story being in the Sacramento Bee and everything was very much in my mind.
I went to a reading the writer Carol Phillips once, and he was saying that literary fiction takes longer than genre fiction because you have to wait for the characters to reveal themselves to you. And I wondered if having, you know, this real sort of framework to hang the story on made that process any quicker for you, or if it actually impeded it?
That's a good question. It didn't, you know, this book didn't go any faster or slower than any other book I've written, so no. I think what was nice about it was the real story gave me sort of places to hit along the map. I knew she had to go here. I knew they had to go there. I knew they had to go to, you know. So it gave me sort of, you know, like a little bit of a guide. But no, the book didn't sort of take me any... Because I think, again, you know, it was about, I don't know what Dorothea Lange or Florence Thompson were like inside of themselves. So I had to invent those two characters the way I would in any book, even a book not based on anybody real. So, no, unfortunately, it didn't go any faster.
Hi, this question addresses setting. I know you mentioned your novel is character-driven. I have to read it. I've been reading reviews of it. I'm sorry, I haven't read it yet. But as a writer, I was wondering if you, to get into the mode of writing during this time of history, went and lived in like a real simplistic fashion, maybe suffered through some food anxiety, you know, turn your lights off or whatever. I wondered if you sort of turned off your technology to do this, or if you altered any of your, you know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally know what you mean. no, I didn't. I certainly traveled to many of the places where the book takes place, but I didn't. I didn't put myself in a sort of deprived situation in order to write about that. I didn't. That's not my process. I think other people might. That might be a useful process for other people, but for me, it's not really necessary. I kind of, sitting at my desk in my bedroom, can kind of go anywhere I need to go. But everybody has different ways of doing it, and I'm sure there are people who write brilliantly doing that very thing. So if that's what you need to get into a understanding of a character, that's your process, you know?
Hi. I think that a photographer does not always know what kind of cultural legacy they are leaving when they're taking that photograph. They're just creating in the moment. But I wonder if you as the author ever have the intent of kind of what are you leaving the reader with, or in a larger sense, if your book, you know, as cultural legacy then becomes, you know, shapes some framework of an understanding of that history, is there intent, or is it you telling your story as a creation that is meaningful to you and it doesn't matter how society or a person feels about it?
That's a great question. You know, I can only hope that my work has any sort of conversation in the cultural legacy, so I don't think I think about that as I'm doing it. I think that one thing I understand about writing now that I've done it for a while is that what I can't know is how the book is going to live in the world, because everybody that reads it brings his or her own subjectivity, life experiences, their emotion on that day when they're reading it, or they, you know, to the reading of the book, and it becomes a very personal interaction for them. I mean, that's something I love about writing, is that I don't really have access to that. That it's once the book is in your hands, it's something that you're creating. You're creating that reading experience. So I don't think that I really think beyond my writing of it. And, you know, when I write, I certainly hope that it's expressing the themes and the feelings that I wanted to express. But I think that I have happily no idea how it's going to feel in any given person's hands. And I think that if I did, it would maybe be a more turgid book, because there would be no element of surprise, you know? There would be sort of, I'm giving you this apple and it's going to be an apple, instead of I'm giving you this fruit and what kind of fruit do you taste, you know? So I think that I don't think a lot about that.
Okay. I think there was someone...
Way up.
Thanks. Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if you or the publisher gave any thought to the Kindle or the e-translation of the book, because the image of the cover is such an important part of the book. And on an e-device, it wouldn't have the impact that it has.
That's like something I've never asked them, but I'm going to the minute I get off of it, because you're right. So they don't have, I don't read e-books, so they don't have covers on them at all?
No.
That's not good. All right, thank you.
But don't judge a book by its cover. Sorry. All right,
buy the real book tonight, please.
There's one more question here.
Hi. I'm thinking about how this photograph and the book, The Grapes of Wrath, that was another thing that, you know, both of them had a profound effect on the country's understanding of what was going on. And I really don't have a well-formed question here, but I guess I'm wondering, in terms of The Grapes of Wrath and the book that you've written, is there some conversation going on at this point about the two of them in relation to each other?
You mean
other,
in the world, like publicity-wise?
Yeah, I guess so.
Oh.
Like I said, I don't
know. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, it's certainly, you know, the Great Depression novel. I mean, that was one of the things you talk about. What was hard about it was like, am I allowed to write a Depression novel after The Grapes of Wrath?
Exactly.
I mean, I did feel that for a long time. I thought, well, you know, who would dare?
Yeah.
But then I thought, you know, yes.
Why not?
You can. There's many other stories to tell. The Joads didn't say it all. But no, I haven't heard that. But I'm sure that, you know, in discussion, I mean, you can't evoke the literature of the Depression without evoking that story.
Well, it will be an interesting counterpoint.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
I purposely, you know, I've read the book, but I didn't read it right before I wrote this, because I really felt like I didn't need that big, fat shadow hanging
over
me.
Yeah. Wise decision.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, Marissa, thank you so much, and thank you all
thank
for
you
coming
very
out.
Much. Thank
it was
you.
Wonderful to have you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.